Ladies and gentlemen, let's go ahead and let's get started. Thank you all for coming. This is a fantastic turnout. In fact, we had booked an even smaller room, but then the interest was so great that we moved in this bigger room, and it looks like this bigger room may not even be big enough. That's a good sign. My name is Mark Baer. I'm the head of Department of International History. And in my department, we always squabble about who should be the annual lecturer. So I decided I'm going to appoint a committee, right? And the committee is going to come up with a list of five names. And then we're going to vote on who we all want to come to be our annual lecturer. And you're looking at the winner right now. Hakim Adi was selected by our department to be our annual lecturer. Perhaps he doesn't need an introduction for all of you, but let's do one anyway. First of all, and the reason we invited him here is because Professor Hakim Adi is an award-winning historian. He was the first historian of African heritage to become a professor of history in Britain. Should I say that again? Let me say that again. He was the first historian of African heritage to become a professor of history in Britain. When were universities founded in Britain? Okay, just check, 800 years ago. And he was appointed professor of the history of Africa and the African diaspora at the University of, a university which won't be named, in 2015. In 2018, he launched the world's, sorry? 14. Was it 14? Well, too late for Britain to have appointed its first historian of African heritage. So he launched the world's first online MRES in the history of Africa and the African diaspora, which trained many students, including a number who are currently engaged in PhD research. But in August 2023, the University of, which won't be named, suspended all recruitment to that program and terminated his employment. Boo. Hakim was instrumental in the founding of the History Matters Initiative in 2014 and is also the founder and consultant historian of the Young Historians Project. He's appeared in many documentary films, on TV, on radio. He's written widely on the history of Africa and the African diaspora, including three history books for children. His publications have been translated into Arabic, French, Spanish, Portuguese, and his books include West Africans in Britain, 1900 to 1960, Nationalism, Pan-Africanism, and Communism in 1998, the 1945 Manchester Pan-African Congress Revisited in 1995, Pan-African History, Political Figures from Africa and the Diaspora since 1787. This came out in 2003. His most recent books are Pan-Africanism and Communism, The Communist International, Africa and the Diaspora, 1919 to 1939, came out in 2013. Pan-Africanism, a history, in 2018. And he also edited Black British History, New Perspectives, in 2019. Black Voices on Britain, 2022. He has written more books than most of us, and they let him, you know, they ended his position. It makes no sense whatsoever. He also wrote Many Struggles, New Histories of African Caribbean People in Britain in 2023. But his latest publication, and I think a lot of what he's going to teach us about tonight, come on in, is the book Africa and Caribbean People in Britain, A History, from Allen Lane 2023, which you could find at any bookstore. Which was shortlisted for the prestigious Wolfson History Prize in Britain this autumn. So without further ado, Hakim Adi. I should also mention there'll be a reception right after the talk, right outside, and everyone's welcome to the reception.
Thank you. Okay, thank you so much, and it's great to be here. Let me just move away from the screen. It's great to be here in the famous LSE. When I was young, or younger, I should say, when I was younger, LSE had the reputation for being a kind of bastion of radicalism. Perhaps after Oxford and Cambridge, the most famous university in the country. I don't know whether it still has that reputation or not. I can see Sabrina and Marlene looking at me. But I have to say, I've never been invited to speak here before. And I'm very glad. I don't know whether it took a second redundancy to persuade everybody at LSE to vote for me and to get me here today. Hopefully there won't be any more redundancies. So thank you so much for coming on a whatever day it is, a Thursday evening. I'm sure there are many more exciting and important things to do rather than being here. And I thank you so much for coming. It's good to see some old friends. Many of my students are here who have also, in a way, almost been also made redundant and have been left without supervision by my former university and treated in a disgraceful way. It's also good to see many of you who have supported us over the last few months, difficult months, signed the petitions and supported in other ways. And to celebrate our struggle, because struggle is always something to be celebrated. As Frederick Douglass said, if there is no struggle, there is no progress. And so we embrace the struggle. I tell my students that they've learned about history from books or from the perspective, a theoretical perspective, but now is the practice. And so we celebrate that practice and celebrate that struggle. And to commemorate it and celebrate it, we've produced these badges. And we encourage everybody to, there are actually two badges. I'm wearing one just for color coordination purposes. And we encourage you to make a donation and to proudly wear your badges supporting our struggle, which is a struggle not just over my employment, important though that is, nor just over the situation facing my students, important though that is, but is also a struggle about defending the significance and importance of history, and in particular the history of Africa and the African diaspora. We don't accept that some university that nobody's ever heard of can just throw away a course as if it's nothing, and throw away students as if they're nothing. I'm sure that's something that LSE would never do. But there are universities around who behave like that, and it's unacceptable. And so we will fight, and we'll continue to fight, and they'll maybe think twice about acting in that way in future. Anyway, I won't go on about that. Maybe I'll come back and say something about that later, but I thank all of you for coming and for your support. So tonight, I wanted to say something about, what is it? Yes. Affirming this history. Why do we need to affirm it? Let's just see if this works. Oh, it does work. Wow. Some years ago in 2015, 2016, some of us got together to design a new GCSE course on migration, which that course still exists, and this is the textbook which accompanies it. And it was greeted in some quarters as a major distortion of history. I won't show you all the things that they said, but the Mail on Sunday, a well-known publication, thought that it should say something about this GCSE course. This is one of the things which they objected to, which we didn't actually say in the book. We could have said it, but we didn't say this. And this is what one of the famous experts and specialists said. I don't know whether you can understand it. It's barely written in English. It tells you something about how Nobel Prizes for Literature are, and Booker Prizes are. We were talking about the Wolfson earlier. We won't say anything more about that, but it's not really coherent. But these are the kind of people they got to attack a GCSE course and a textbook. So this demonstrates the fact that this, our history, which is essentially the history of Britain, merely presented from the perspective of those of African and Caribbean heritage, needs to be affirmed, not defended necessarily, but affirmed. And those who find it objectionable that somebody might say that Africans were here before Angles and Saxons, these are just historical facts. There's nothing subversive about it. And probably Africans were here probably 1,000 years before the Angles and Saxons. Of course, those who make a big deal about Angles and Saxons know nothing about the history of this country anyway, because what is the significance of Angles and Saxons? Any people who study Angles and Saxons here? No, okay. Well, nobody admits to studying them. Anyway, enough of all that. We don't need to defend facts, but it is a fact that this history is continually attacked. My book is attacked. People go on YouTube and make videos about this, about the children's books and so on, and say that it's subversive, it's brainwashing children, it's whatever it is. How they react to a gentleman like Cheddar Man, I'm not sure. Because, as you all know, the oldest representation that we have of a Briton is this gentleman here. It's about, this is obviously not him, a reconstruction for those of you who don't study history. You need to get a better ringtone than that. That's disappointing. Not that I want to draw attention to it, but you've drawn attention to it. So Cheddar Man is the first Briton that we have physical evidence of. And at the time when he was around, about 10,000 years ago, everybody in Britain looked like this. Everybody in Europe looked like this. And without saying more about him, Cheddar Man was also, like everybody else in this country, an immigrant. This country is a country of migrants from its earliest period. And if there are some people around who can't get over that, then that's just too bad. But that is the history of this country. And what is important is that we present that history and don't apologize to anybody for so doing. So that's what I'm going to do tonight. And to say something about what is contained in the book. Not everything, because I wanted to say something about maybe what needs affirming, and also because LSE is very keen on what they refer to as international history. I'm sure there's a definition of that somewhere, but I haven't actually looked it up. Some of us have the thinking that all history is international, but anyway, we'll move away from that. Okay, so let me take another example from the book and from the history of this country. This is another reconstruction of somebody who lived in this country a long time ago, about 1,700 years ago. She is another figure or another personality who often comes under attack. And it seems that those who take objection to the history of this country in its earliest period have a very big problem accepting that there were Africans here, whether it's 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago. Of course, when you have physical evidence, it becomes very difficult for them to maneuver. And this is some of the physical evidence we have. So this is a representation of somebody who's generally known as Ivory Bangle Lady. She was lived and died in the city of York, roughly 1,700 years ago. These days there is historians or archaeologists have the ability of using DNA techniques, DNA analysis, to analyze the skeletal remains of people who lived that far back in history. And are also able to reconstruct, in some ways, how they would have looked. And so this young woman would have looked something like this. She died at quite an early age. But she is just one of those Africans who were here in Roman times. And why would it be surprising if she lived here at the same time as Septimius Severus, the Roman emperor who came from Libya and who brought with him soldiers, women, children, others, who also were from North Africa. And North Africa is a big place. Lots of different types of people came during that period and in the period afterwards. There's nothing surprising about any of this. But again and again, it needs to be affirmed that this is not something that began in 1948 or some other strange date. This is the nature of this country. And some of you may have come across in the newspapers, I think only about a year ago, a finding or analysis of a finding, another skeletal remains from a young child who was found not very far from where I live in Kent, dating from about the 7th century. And the DNA of this skeleton was analyzed, and it was found that this young child, her DNA, originated from what is today Nigeria, or the region of Nigeria. It's not known whether she herself traveled from Nigeria. It's probably unlikely what is today Nigeria. It's probably unlikely that she did. It was probably her father who came to this country from that region. Why he came, we don't yet know. But this is just the kind of evidence that you find. And it's this kind of evidence which has been attacked in the House of Commons recently, I understand, by somebody saying that people who carry out this kind of analysis, actually from a later period, from the period of the Black Death in the 14th century, some archaeologists carried out some DNA research on some skeletal remains, and they found that some of the people who'd been buried in Smithfield also were of African heritage. Is that a big deal? But it raised a parliamentary debate. The government ministers start attacking archaeologists and say that they're whatever terms they use. Why should that be the case? This is what the scientific evidence suggests. Just as the site in Kent showed that this young 9-year-old girl also had DNA, which showed that she was of African heritage. In fact, in her case, somebody commented, I think actually one of the archaeologists commented, and she was buried in the same manner as all the other people. Well, why wouldn't she have been? Why is there some, this is peculiar ideas that people have? That's at least a better ringtone. It's a better ringtone. By the end of the evening, we'll have found a really good. I haven't turned off my phone, so we may get a really good ringtone. So in the case of Ivory Bangle Lady, one of the important things about her was that she was buried with jewelry. She was clearly somebody of high status, a person of wealth and prestige and so on and so forth. And so again, people have had to think again. She wasn't just some African woman who'd been brought in some servile status and so on, which everybody said, yeah, okay, we can understand that. She was clearly a wealthy, free person. But these are the affirmations that have to be made continually in this history. Now, when we come to Tudor times, we have pictorial representations, or we have one or two, not very many. And this is a well-known representation of the royal trumpeter John Blanc. And he is significant only that he's a representative of many hundreds of other Africans who were here in Tudor times. Africans who were workers, who were property owners, who were divers, who were musicians, who were monks, who were different types of people who happened to be here. And of course, they probably, almost most of them would have come from somewhere else. Probably mainly from Southern Europe, from Spain, from Portugal, some of them directly from the African continent. This was a time when England's relationship with Africa was beginning to change. There was direct relations between the Tudor court, particularly Elizabeth Tudor, and North Africa, and so on and so forth. So looking at this history just gives us a wider international perspective on the history of Britain and on the relationship of Britain between Britain and other countries, other parts of the world, including Africa. It shouldn't be a big deal. Of course, we have lots of other information from Tudor times about those Africans who were here, letters from the royal court, and so on and so forth. So nothing that should be alarming to anyone. Then we have figures like William Ansell. Now, William Ansell is a very interesting personality, and I include him in the book and in the presentations I give because he tells us something about the relationship which existed between this country and Africa in the 18th century, which some people wish to forget about. Now, in the 18th century, Britain was the world's leading human trafficker. That is to say, it engaged in the trafficking of more African men, women, and children than any other country in the world. That was the business of Britain. And, of course, it was mainly the business of the monarchy. That's what the monarchy did. Every monarch from Elizabeth Tudor up until Victoria, we say up to William IV, that was their business. You know that William IV got up when he was still Duke of Clarence in the House of Lords at the time when there was some discussion on abolition. He said, "What do you mean abolition? This is our business. This is what's made Britain great. This is what's brought us wealth. Why are you talking about stopping it? This is our business." But it wasn't only the business of the monarchy. Of course, there were others in this country, but also others in Africa. It was impossible to traffic hundreds of thousands, millions in total, from the African continent without the collaboration, shall we call it, of Africans themselves. When I say Africans themselves, African rulers of various kinds. So William Ansell is a very good illustration of all of this. William Ansell was sent by his father. His father was a ruler, you can say, coastal ruler in what is today Ghana, who wanted his son to be educated in Britain. Of course, these were the days, I dare say, before LSE. So he had to send him somewhere else. He sent his son to be educated in Britain, as was the tradition of West African rulers by this time, many of them. On his way, unfortunately, the person that he was entrusted to turned out to be untrustworthy. He kidnapped William, took him to Barbados, sold him into slavery, much to the upset of his father. Now, I forgot to mention that William's father was a gentleman who engaged in the selling of other people's sons and daughters, which he thought was a perfectly reasonable thing to do. But when it happened to his own son, he thought it was rather unreasonable. So he immediately contacted his business associates in Britain. They went by the name of the Royal Africa Company. They were called the Royal Africa Company because they were a monopoly dominated by the monarchy. He contacted them and said, unless you bring my son back immediately, there will be no more business between us, no more human trafficking. The Royal Africa Company, very concerned, immediately went to Barbados. They found William. They brought him back to London. They gave him this rather nice suit of clothes. He had his portrait painted. Somebody wrote a biography of him. He had a nice holiday. He stayed in the house of the president of the Board of Trade, a government minister responsible for human trafficking. After he'd had a little holiday, he was taken back to his father in West Africa. The father said, thank you so much. Now business can recommence. And so on. So this one personality illustrates something about this whole period of the 18th century and what this country was about, or what it was about for the monarchy and the rich and powerful. But of course, for the vast majority of people, they had an entirely different perspective on things. And in order to uncover that perspective, we have to look at the lives of other Africans. And this is one of the most famous of those Africans, Alaudo Equiano. Some of you may have heard of him. Born around about 1745 in what is today Nigeria, and went through all kinds of difficulties, was kidnapped, was transported across the Atlantic, was taken to the Caribbean, went to North America, eventually found himself in Britain. He traveled to various other places as well. He was an international figure. And this history we're concerned with is an international history. When he came here, his great fame rested on his autobiography, the interesting narrative. And one of the interesting things about this narrative is that he referred to himself as the African. Indeed, he was probably one of the first people to conceive of this idea of being an African, with all the connotations that that brings to mind. So he wrote an autobiography about his life, about being kidnapped, about being transported, about all the things that happened and so on. It became a bestseller. It was translated into other languages and so on. And as well as being a writer, he was also, we can say, an abolitionist. He campaigned for the abolition of human trafficking. And he was one of, actually, literally millions, because at that time, the abolitionist campaign in this country, 1780s, early 1790s, was probably the biggest political campaign ever in this country's history. And being one of the biggest political campaigns in this country's history, you've all learned about it at school, yep? No. And you've all learned about it at LSE, yes? No. How is that possible? How is it possible that the biggest political campaign in Britain's history, which involved working people, which involved women, which involved Africans, nobody knows anything about it? So that is the importance of the affirmation of this history, that we have to talk about these things. Sometimes I tell a story, some of you may have heard it before, some of you may not. I may not have time to tell it, but I'll tell it anyway. Is that my water? Brilliant. A few years ago, I was talking to a teacher, youngish teacher, young English woman, and she said to me, yes, I'll do that for me, thanks. She said to me, you know, this history is rather difficult to teach. Excuse me, but it's rather dry in here. She said, this history is rather difficult to teach. I said, is it? Why is that? She said, well, you know, one feels so guilty. I said, really? About what? She said, well, you know, one's ancestors were engaged in human trafficking. And so. I said, really? Were they? I said, it's more likely that your ancestors were boycotting the consumption of sugar, were signing petitions to Parliament demanding an end to human trafficking, than they were going around kidnapping people. I said, you must understand the history of this country. She was a history teacher, but she had been so brainwashed, to use an expression which is used about me sometimes, that she had taken on the history of the white men of property as if it was her own history, not the history of the majority of people in this country. So this affirmation is extremely important. And to just maybe give another illustration, Lauro Equiano was, as I said, an early Pan-Africanist. He was a member of an organization called the Sons of Africa, made up of African men. But he was also a member of something called the London Corresponding Society, one of the radical organizations of that time. And this is a letter written by the secretary of that organization. He refers to Gustavus Vassa, which was the other name of Lauro Equiano. And you'll see that he's writing to somebody, and he says that Equiano is actually staying with him in his house here in London. But he says that, I hear that you are a zealous friend to the abolition of that cursed traffic, blah, blah, blah. I infer from that circumstance that you are a zealous friend to freedom on the broad basis of the rights of man, etc., etc., etc. In other words, he says, I infer that if you're for the rights of black people, then you must also be for the rights of white people. If you're for the rights of white people, then you must also be for the rights of black people. In other words, you should be for the rights of all, for the liberty of all. This was the politics of working people in this country in the 18th century. It's very advanced politics. Some people today haven't yet got to this stage. So this is what Equiano, Thomas Spence, London Corresponding Society, what they were about. What the powers that be, the rich and powerful, were about is something rather different. Okay. So I thought I don't usually show this photo, picture of Mary Seacole, although it is in the book, but I wanted to just say something, not about Mary Seacole necessarily, but Mary Seacole, as you know, is famous for what? Nursing where? In the Crimea. Okay. So I thought, as the Crimea is again topical, it's just an interesting reflection. Because today, of course, we're in another dispute, we can call it, between England, Britain, and Russia. I don't want to get too political, even though this is LSE. I think you're allowed to be a little bit political in LSE. We can say it's a certain kind of war. It's between Britain and Russia. Another country is kind of being used as a proxy. I won't say which one. Various justifications are given, and so on. And if we go back to the 19th century, the Crimean War there was also a war between Britain and Russia, using a proxy, various justifications were given, and so on. So the question is for you, what was Mary Seacole doing? Was she doing good things? Was it a good war? Was it a just war? I can use that very political expression here in LSE. Or was it an unjust war? I'm not going to tell you the answer to that. I just want you to think about it. Because often we and I'm not, this is not a criticism of Mary Seacole, but in history often we celebrate various figures without thinking about the context in which we're celebrating them, thinking about them, and so on. So affirming history also means understanding the context in which things are done and said, and so on. So I'm going to move from one war to another war very quickly because of time. And also because here we have one of Tottenham's greatest players. Why are you laughing? There's nothing funny about Tottenham. Walter Daniel Toll, who was a goal scorer for Spurs, as most Tottenham players are. Strangely enough, he's only partly known as a Tottenham player. Sabrina's calling to you from the middle row. Sabrina and Marlene are calling, disrupting everything, so you can take your seat. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Good to see you.
Out, guys.
Yeah, you're doing not too bad. I hope you're a Tottenham supporter after all that. Okay, so Walter Daniel Toll is known as one of the earliest black footballers, but he has another distinction you're probably aware of, in that he was the first British-born black person, we can say, to be made an officer in the British Army. And the reason for that was there was a color bar in the army, as in other areas of society in this country. And if you were a person not of pure European descent, you could not become an officer. But he became an officer. He wasn't the only person of African or Caribbean heritage to be an officer, but he was the only one, or the first one, born in this country. He was born in Folkestone in Kent. And so we celebrate it. They say, isn't that good? It's not good that he was killed in action, the Second Battle of the Somme in 1917, but we still kind of celebrate it and big up Walter Daniel Toll and so on. But then the question is, what kind of war was he fighting in? Now, if you listen to the experts, people like Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, they will tell you that the First World War is all about those beastly Germans. If it's not the beastly Germans, it's all about saving poor little Belgium. You know poor little Belgium? The country whose king had just slaughtered 10 million Africans? Yeah, that Belgium. Or they say it was all about saving Western civilization. And wasn't it good that Britain joined, and so on and so forth. And some people get caught up in all of that without actually examining what was going on. So let's have a look at a different perspective. We can call this a Jamaican perspective, although Isaac was based here in London at the time. So he has another analysis of the First World War, which I would argue is actually much closer to the reality. And his analysis led him to be imprisoned. He was imprisoned in Pentonville, tortured nearly to death, as a conscientious objector, somebody who on principle was opposed to war, and you could say particularly opposed to this war, which was a war between two gangs of robbers, as to who could redivide the world between them. And the redivision of that world led to what? Something that's going on right at this moment. Because the whole Palestine situation, and of course one doesn't want to be too political at LSE, arises from that redivision of the world. And of course the Balfour Declaration that was made during the war, the Sykes-Picot Agreement that was made between Britain and France to redivide that part of the world and so on. So that's what that war was about. If you just look at Africa, you'll see that those powers that won the war, Britain and France, redivided and confiscated Germany's colonies and took them for their own and so on and so forth. And the same was true of Palestine. They called it a mandate, but it's effectively it was a colony of Britain. So looking at this history, affirming it, can also tell us something not just about the world in the past, but also the world in the present. If we didn't have this, we might struggle to understand things, maybe, or maybe we understand them more easily, the fact that we do have this history to guide us. Okay, how's that picture looking? Not too bad. Not too bad. Okay, so I was thought I'd say something for all the Nigerians in the audience, especially for Tayo, I guess. So this is one of the first Nigerian organizations in this country, Nigerian Progress Union, formed in Ladbroke Grove in 1924. It was interestingly jointly founded. Don't be sorry, I'm going to have a drink. And what's interesting about this organization, again, it shows you the internationalism of this history. These, mainly young men, but also some young women, were students here. They were concerned about Nigeria, obviously, which is a British colony. They were concerned also about the way that Africans were portrayed in the press. And they took up a campaign against various newspapers for what today we would call racist reporting. And so they played quite an important role in that period. But this Nigerian organization was actually co-founded by the woman sitting in the middle there, who happened to be a Jamaican. Not that there's anything wrong with that. And her name was Amy Ashwood Garvey. Heard of her? Good. Okay, good. And she became, of course, one of the key activists, we can say, throughout the 20th century. But she really began her political activity with the Nigerian Progress Union. And one could say all sorts of other things about them. I'm conscious of time. I'm going to move on just a little bit. But there she is again from Trafalgar Square. Yes, you recognized it. From the mid-1930s, this is a protest, a demonstration about the fascist Italy's invasion of Ethiopia. Again, I said I want to stress the internationalism of our history. And here is another demonstration, this one from Cardiff, on a similar theme, probably a little bit later, but again, mid to late 1930s, a demonstration which is really a kind of anti-fascist demonstration, but also an anti-war demonstration. As you can see from the banner, you can't quite see the top of it, it says peace lovers demand collective security, which was the policy favored by the Soviet Union and those who thought that those countries that called themselves democracies should unite against the fascist powers and so on. I'm going to move on to, because one of the themes that emerges and why it's so important to, I say, affirm this history, of course, many people participated in during the Second World War, women as well as men, and this is one of the women who participated. And they participated even though there was a color bar in the armed forces and also the auxiliary services. And this young woman, Amelia King, who was born in Stepney in East London, was actually barred from joining the Land Army, which was the organization mainly of women working on the land and agriculture to produce food and so on. And it became quite a celebrated case. Those of you who can read it will see that it the leaflet mentions other cases of racism during the war. And this was important because obviously a war ostensibly fought against fascism should not have permitted racism to take place within the country. But of course, that was one of the problems that those who participated as air raid patrol wardens, as firefighters, as land army, whatever, faced during that period. And it's important to bear that in mind. Of course, many others actually traveled to this country from Africa, from the Caribbean, to participate in that war effort. And that shouldn't be forgotten about either. I put this in, yeah, Ty, I put this one in for you, actually. And for all the YHP members here. This is somebody else who contributed to the war effort, Ademola Ademola, known, I guess, as Nurse Ademola. And she was, as her name suggests, from Nigeria. She trained in London, at Guy's, I think, if I remember correctly. But what is important about her is that a film was made about her during the war to actually show the international character of the war effort. And of course, that film unfortunately has been lost, as films about Africans in Britain generally get lost. Anyway, that's another topic. But she was a significant figure in many ways, and she was just one of many African women who came to this country in the 40s, in the 30s, in the 20s, as nurses, before the NHS was even created. So again, whatever aspect of British history we look at, it has an international character, and a character in which those of African and Caribbean heritage play a significant role. And Nurse Ademola was a member of the West African Students' Union that we see pictured here outside their HQ in Camden, often known as Africa House at the time. And the West African Students' Union, or WASU as it was known, was formed in 1925. It was probably the most important organization of its type at this time. It campaigned against racism, against colonial rule. It was probably the first African organization to call for independence, certainly in Nigeria, which it demanded during the Second World War. And it was an international, or we can say pan-African organization, because although it was based, its headquarters were in London, it had branches throughout West Africa. In fact, the money for this hostel was actually raised in Africa. And it also had connections in the US, in India, in Brazil, and in many other places. So this, again, is the nature of this history. And if I had time, I could go in and say even more about it. But it's important that we affirm it, we don't lose sight of it, and the contribution that these significant people made to the history and struggles in this country. Well, I mean, you can't get more international, internationalist, maybe is the right word, than the Manchester Pan-African Congress, which I've spoken about many times before. I won't say anything, I don't think much about it tonight, other than to draw your attention to this slogan here. Just see that? Yeah. So this is the politics of Pan-Africanism in its heyday. And one, there's so many things there. I love that one of Marx. Labor in the white skin cannot emancipate itself while labor in the black skin is enslaved. And there's so many others there that what an important contribution that is. And this Congress, which people hardly know about in this country, people still talk about in Africa. as creating that vision of a new Africa that should emerge at the end of the Second World War. An Africa without borders, without the Eurocentric political system, or the alien political system, as they called it, without the monopoly of capital, and so on and so forth. That vision not yet realized. But the importance was to have that vision, and then to fight for it. And maybe my next book is going to actually be about that fight to realize that vision. Maybe. Or it may be another book. We're not quite sure which it's going to be yet. I might write them both at the same time. We'll see. I'm only joking. Okay, so 1948 is a very important year. Some people get confused about its significance. And there's a lot of propaganda around that it's all about some ship. And we have to be very wary of that mischievous notion. But 1948 is mainly important because of the Turpin brothers. And here they are, good-looking young men, all of them. And the most famous of the three was Randolph Turpin, who you will have heard of, I'm sure. If you haven't heard of Randolph, you'll have heard of Sugar Ray Robinson. You heard of him? Yeah. Randolph Turpin beat him to become world middleweight champion. But I'm not going to talk about him. I'm going to talk about his younger brother, Lionel, or Dick, as he was known to his friends. And Dick Turpin, or Lionel Turpin, is important for us because he did something that nobody had done before, or certainly nobody had done in the 20th century. He became a British boxing champion. Now, there were many black boxers before 1948, but they were barred from fighting for British titles. Because unless you were a person of pure European descent, you could not compete for a top British boxing title. Until that bar, that barrier, was broken by Lionel Turpin in 1948. And that was a very important breach of racism in this country. Of course, the racism continued, but it had been breached in an important place. And the struggle would continue for some time after that. In fact, here you can see, this is 1950s from the Caribbean Labour Congress. It's particularly highlighting the Birmingham branch and Henry Gunter, who was a campaigner against racism in Birmingham, a very important campaigner. I guess we can say a communist as well, as many of those activists in that period were. And this struggle against racism is very much a feature of, unfortunate feature of, history in the 20th century. This is another example from the 1970s, some of you will be familiar with. And you'll also be familiar with the struggle that Winston True, one of the over four, waged for over 50 years to clear his name. And that in itself was an important struggle. It shows that however unjust society may be, however racist the police, the judiciary, the governments, and so on may be, that you should, one should, we should continue to fight. And our security lies in our struggle, as we say. One should never give up. And Winston never gave up, and he was exonerated, and he and all the others were cleared just a few couple of years ago. So that brings me to almost one of my last slides, because while I'm on the theme of racism, it's only correct that I mentioned my friend Aggie Lewis and her son Shenny, and some of you will have heard this story before, but I think it's always good to repeat it, because Shenny was taken into hospital about 12 years ago and never came out. He was, let's say the hospital staff felt unable to cope with him. He was an outpatient. The definition of outpatient being that you can get out of a hospital. But in his case, they called the police. A dozen police came and they killed Shelley. And Aggie and her family and supporters have campaigned for every year since then. No one has been held to account. I'm sure you're aware that before the sentencing of the killer of Dalian Atkinson, no police officer in this country had ever been, I don't think even been charged, let alone been convicted of the killing of a black person in this country. But in Shelley's case, no one has been brought to book. Various changes have been made to the law to protect people in hospital and other places of that kind. So this history is also an important reminder. In the book, I talk about also the case of Stephen Lawrence, which, as you know, is ongoing. It's, 30 years old now? It's ongoing. Was it only last year the BBC? Issued a report which said that there weren't five killers, there were six. And the police were told straight away, they never interviewed the sixth one, who's now died. So has anyone been held to account? Have any Home Secretaries been arrested? So this history is important for us. It's our memory, it's our collective memory. That we don't lose sight of reality of the world in which we live and the importance of not just being, not just existing, but also struggling for a better world. And that brings me to the end of the book, 2020. And of course, many things were demanded in 2020, but amongst those demands were that the importance of history, that young people in this country, especially young black people, but young people in general, should be taught a history that's accurate, which is inclusive, which is not Eurocentric, which includes Africa, which includes Asia, the two largest continents in the world. Africa, of course, the birthplace of everybody, we can say, in this room. In the sense that we're all Africans, all of African descent. Some of us are more African than others. But how can you not know something about the history of Africa? So anyway, these were the demands of 2020. And so affirming this history is extremely important for all of us, for everyone. And some of us who are getting a bit long in the tooth have been at it a long time. This is the organization we set up in 1991. It's generally called BASA because it had such a long name that nobody could remember it, so we changed it. But its name was indicative of what we thought was important at that time, which was that schools, universities, archives, museums, libraries actually reflected the history of everybody in this country, not just the white men of property. And so we set up that organization to campaign and to organize for change and to organize those who were engaged in writing and researching this history to get together. And the organization has become so well known that some people who had very little to do with it now claim that they were founder members and so on and so forth, which is good. That shows it's successful. Then we, talking about affirming things, this year is the 10th anniversary of the founding of History Matters in 2014. History Matters was established because we were concerned that so few young people of African and Caribbean heritage were studying history in this country. At that time, history was amongst young black people, we can say, the third most unpopular subject at university, only agriculture and veterinary science were more unpopular amongst black students. There were very few postgraduate students, very few black academic historians. There was a headline in a newspaper that only three black students trained as history teachers in schools the previous year. And at that time, there were very few history teachers in school. I think 226 out of a total of 16,000 in this country. So we thought something should be done. And in those circumstances, it's always good for people to get together and discuss what should be done and what the problems are. So we held this conference in London to discuss what we should do, because nobody else was doing anything, and without mentioning any names. And out of that conference, the Young Historians Project was founded in 2015 to encourage young people to engage with history, to have a vehicle to encourage them. And I'm very pleased to see some of those YHP members here tonight, former members, former coordinators, and of course now we have, YHP has its own PhD students, and those have even got their PhDs now, which we claim is all down to us, not down to anything else. But anyway, this has been created. So the point I'm making here is the necessity to affirm. In our business, you cannot just be a historian, somebody who, I don't know, what historians do, what do? Writes books, gives a few lectures. That's not sufficient. It's not, we're not, we don't have that luxury, in my opinion. And if you don't believe me, I am the evidence of it. Because, as you heard at the beginning, I was the first person of African heritage to become professor of history in this country. And we created something at a certain university, a master's program, which again came out of the History Matters Conference, was specifically designed for mature black students to encourage them to come back to history, because that's what people at the conference said was required. We set it up, we put it online. Anybody anywhere in the country or anywhere in the world could join it. People joined. We produced 7 PhD students in 5 years. Some of those PhD, some of our MRes people are here tonight. Some of them have gone on to do PhDs are here tonight. People like Marlene and Ray and others. That's what we created. And as a result, we had a cohort of about 16 black postgraduate students, which we say is the biggest in the country. Nobody's contradicted us yet. There may be bigger ones. But for a university that no one's ever heard of, in a place no one's ever been to, including me, 16 or so isn't bad. It's not bad. I don't know how many LSEs got. We won't put them on the spot, but ask them. Okay, so that's what we created. But as you heard, that was all smashed, as if it meant nothing. So that is why we must affirm ourselves and our history. We don't have the luxury of sitting around just writing books, giving a few lectures. We have to organize ourselves and others and continue to say this history is important. This particular master's program was the only one of its kind in Britain, in Europe, and so on and so forth. Now it's gone. So these things are important. Our history, we say history matters, and we mean it. It's important. And I'm very pleased to have shared some of it with you and some of my thoughts about it with you tonight. I'm sorry I've gone on a bit long. That's why I always tend to want to say too many things and show too many slides. So I'm going to stop. And if people have got any queries or questions or comments, I'm happy.
Thank you for a wonderful talk. Would you like to take some questions? Yeah, you have got time and energy for questions. So, I'm not going to try to reach out with the microphone. It's too dense here. But if you could please just speak loudly, and we'll take some questions. Yes, please.
Apologies for being late. Thank you very much for the part of the lecture that I heard. It's rather a comment rather than a question. I think it's so important what you say about us not being historians, not just standing on the sidelines, but actually being active in doing the work that we need to do to combat the things that you've spoken about already. And I just wanted to say that when you put a picture of Aggie and Jamie up on the screen, I took a shot of it. I sent it to Aggie because she's a very close friend of mine. And she actually has already written back and said that you're a very, very, very dear friend. We're at SOAS together, and she wanted me to send you her love. So I wanted to do it in open forum. Can you imagine that? I can't get over people like Aggie and Doreen Lawrence who suffered a loss of a loved one, a child especially. And they go all out. So she actually campaigned for the legislation, Shaney's, colloquially known as Shaney's Law. And that's so that healthcare professionals have the training so it doesn't happen again. Wasn't able to get it to the police because 11 police officers effectively killed her son. But I just take my hat off to people like Aggie and to people like you. So just keep us on our toes because we need to play on. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'm just curious why you think that young people are not studying history.
Well, I can tell you what people said. We've got young people here. Well, don't look too old yourself, if you don't mind me saying that. But I can tell you what people said at the conference we held, and probably people would say similar things, and I can tell you what people said in 2020. They said that the history that they learn in schools is not about them or people who look like them. It's very Eurocentric, similarly at universities, and so people don't have very much interest in it. It's very often taught in a Eurocentric way. You could say even those of us I studied African history at university, but even that was taught in a Eurocentric way. So that's, I think, the problem. We heard, some people have done some research into these things. I mean, we heard some horror stories as well. One is that what is very often taught in schools or in the worst schools is about human trafficking and enslavement. We heard stories that children are asked to reenact these kind of things and reenact them year after year. So you might go through all of whatever, primary school or all of secondary school, and that's what you do, which is it's kind of tantamount to child abuse. And then there is the general environment of Eurocentrism, which excludes people from history. It doesn't only exclude people of African heritage or African and Caribbean heritage, often women and so on are excluded as well. Some of you will remember a few years ago when Michael Gove was Education Secretary, he designed a whole history curriculum, which was just about the white men of property. So that's essentially the problem. Then you have some cases. We had a case with parents don't want their kids to study history because of its Eurocentrism, because they think it's going to mess up their heads and all this kind of thing. So those are the kind of reasons that people gave. And in the book I mentioned some of the comments that young people made in 2020 when they protested about what they'd been taught. They didn't learn anything, they didn't know anything unless they found it out for themselves and so on, which was a situation I had when I was at school, and I was at school in the last century, a very long time ago, where you go through your whole education and you never hear anything about Africa. And if you do hear anything, it's negative. So we're in the 21st century now. And these things need to be addressed. There are greater possibilities today, but the situation is problematic because today most schools are academies. They don't have to follow the national curriculum. And so the goalposts have moved. When in former days we used to make a big deal about national curriculum, making it more inclusive and all that kind of thing. Now it doesn't matter how inclusive it is, they can all ignore it. So it takes a big effort to educate people in general, to educate teachers, to educate parents, to educate everybody, that this history is important. And from what I've said today, this is part of British history. But British history is being presented in a very Eurocentric way, which it's not that it just excludes people, it's that whole history is distorted. Whether it's about the First World War, whether it's about the 18th century, whether it's about the Romans, whether it's about the first Britons. Disinformation is being spread. And it's important. And this is why the closure of the course, my sacking, all of that is symptomatic of that, whatever the university might claim. It's symptomatic of it. And so for that reason, we think it's very, very important to take a stand and to fight and to raise the kind of wider issues about what's going on.
Yeah, that's quite a good segue into the question that I was going to ask, because given the need to affirm our history, given the need to have such a course like the one that you ran, and given where we are at the moment, whether it's subject to a legal challenge or prospective legal challenge, what's happening with the course right now? I mean, is it in a bed? What's happening to the students, prospective students, those interested in doing it? Is there a potential home like LSE or any other University of London?
Are you the director of LSE? Well, you're obviously a person with a certain amount of power and influence. You've hit the nail on the head. I mean, we are looking for a home. The students are here. I mean, they can speak for themselves. But the essence of it is that they are without education. Nobody is supervising them. Their studies have been disruptive, effectively on hold for the past 7 months. The university, we won't mention, has no specialist in the history of Africa or the African diaspora for that matter, and is not capable of supervising the students. Neither do the students wish to be supervised by non-specialists. The course is effectively closed. I'm unemployed. It's as simple as that. So we're looking for a new home, particularly to solve the problem facing the students. And some of the master students were maybe like a semester away from completing. Some PhD students have maybe got a year to go, others just started. So we've got a whole range of students. We're open to offers, as they say. Woman in the window. Yes, sorry. Are you going to hold the mic as well?
Yes, because I wanted everybody to hear my thoughts. The thing is that it's planned and it's a strategy. What happened to the MRes course? We are living in a society where there is known systemic racism and a profound level of anti-blackness. I can't think of any other course where they could just stop it just like that and not even inform the students. I think it's the height of disrespect. It's absolutely disgusting. And my feeling is that the way we fight against this whole, it's not the same thing, but you know, that narrative of DEI must die and, you know, the removal of our history, because what being ahistoric does is it's a form of racism denial, all right? It's planned. So the best way to sort of like push against that narrative is to organize and collectively resist the systemic racism that's definitely be in place. So it wasn't a question, it was a statement.
So I must thank Evie and one of our greatest and most loyal supporters. And it's great that we have such people supporting us. Anyway, as I said before, we need to keep up that struggle. Yeah, go ahead.
Greetings. It's funny enough, I've got your chair, so you know. I'm your new one. No, sorry. I'm from the Congo originally, so I'm very passionate about history. And it's interesting that, you know, in the Congo, you know, we had cities called like Elizabeth, you know, Ville, you know, Livingstonville, when, you know, the British never really colonized us. Even the Portuguese, you know, we not really talked about, you know, about the Portuguese, you know, playing a major part in our enslavement. But we're only talking about the Belgians. And so, and it's also funny to find that, you know, from Egypt all the way to South Africa, you see all the British colonies, and then you have a gap, you know, in the Congo, and then down all the British colonies. Very interesting, very, very interesting geopolitical, you know, system. But my question is that, you know, obviously, you know, I am a history maker. I'm a versatile artist, a poet, musician. I can name, you know, many names and titles. So it's a question and a statement in terms of, you know, being very creative and also, you know, more than just writing books and teaching. It's about, you know, being a struggle, you know, and keeping it real. So it's a proposition, a proposal, live and direct, as a, you know, as a spoken word artist. It's about, you know, keeping it real. And like I said, I'm an advocate for that. Not just the British history, but the African history worldwide as a Congo bongo man. So my proposal is that let's have a chat and take it from there, see?
No problem. No problem. Yeah, I mean, I did, you know, one of the problems that we have is that the history, the immensity of the history, that it's not possible, or certainly wasn't possible tonight, to come and speak about everything. And I did say at the beginning that it's possible that my next book will be a history of Africa, which is in itself is actually quite a difficult thing to do. But all these histories are important. That's why one of the things that we tried to do, and we tried to do with the MRes, we didn't separate the history of Africa from the history of the African diaspora, because we see this as one history or an interrelated history. And we don't think that because Africans were taken out of the African continent that they suddenly stop being Africans or they stop being the makers of African history. And to give an example, we started the MRes with the famous Haitian Revolution. And those of you who know anything about the Haitian Revolution will know that it was the act of Africans, that is to say people born in the African continent, the vast majority of them, many of them came from the Congo region, And they brought with them their, particularly their military knowledge as a result of the wars that had taken place in the Congo in the preceding period, but also their...
Something happened in Brazil too, so it's good.
Exactly. That's why, that's the point I'm making, that this history is all interrelated. So tonight I chose to speak about a particular aspect of that history. So that's not excluding. If we'd had longer, I'd talk about the connection between Haiti and Britain, the connection between Congo and Britain, the connection between Brazil and Britain, and so on. Some of it, anyway, I won't go into all that now. So there are other people who want to ask questions.
Now there are three people towards the back, one person here towards the front, and one person in the corner. So maybe people can ask their questions.
You ask.
We'll get a few questions.
Sure, whatever you like. You're in charge.
We want to get as many voices as we can. There were three people in the back.
So my question is, I didn't realize you had... One has the presumption that maybe it's happening in academia, you know, unknown to the rest of us. So I'm appalled. But so my question is, what can we do to support you? From my perspective, I talk to most of my community, so I look after the Windrush community in terms of property, and if you're a landlord, I help you to navigate the very challenging environment that we're in. I have a theory that the current rental market was fueled by our parents buying property because we were locked out of the system in the 40s, 50s and 60s, and that what we're seeing now is again locking us out of the system, trying to take that property away from us. I came from history from a perspective of law and legislation, and when you look back in history, you see that we actually the Land Act that was about removing people from the land. So, you know, that's my. So I'm a broadcaster, I do a radio show on a Friday. I'd love to have you on so that you can discuss this with all of us. At home, I taught my children our history. I taught them that it was foundational. But most of the material I was looking at in the 80s was very Americanized. So it's wonderful that that we're talking about it from a British perspective. So my children are grown, but certainly I'll be handing it along to my wider family. But other than that, you know, whatever can be done practically for us to come together and maybe support you. And I personally would like to see this course being run independently funded so that you don't suffer the same consequences.